Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Prakash Kashwan, editor of Climate Justice in India, published this year by Cambridge University Press. Dr. Kashwan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And yeah, look forward to sharing about this exciting book project.
Okay, so to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to work on this book?
Sure. So currently, I'm an associate professor of environmental studies at Brandeis University. And it's just brand new for me here at Brandeis. I was at UConn for 11 years until the end of the last academic year. My work focuses on environmental and climate justice, environmental politics and policy, particularly in the context of international and global environmental and climate governance. Almost all of my work is quite interdisciplinary. So I was trained partly in political science, partly in policy sciences, and I engage very regularly with colleagues and scholars in geography, anthropology, and all of the other kinds of social sciences. I have a deep interest in relating the science part of climate science and environmental science with the questions of justice. And maybe that's the part that we can talk about later in the chat. And the other sort of thing that I'd like to share with the listeners is that before coming to academia, I had a first career in international development, and that continues to shape how I do my research and scholarship and teaching for sure. So that's an important feature of all of my work. The book happened because of a confluence of two factors. One, I started a new research project on urban climate governance and urban climate justice in India. And as I went around the town talking to different researchers and scholars and experts and people on the ground, I realized that India's climate justice narrative was so strongly shaped by this whole narrative of international climate justice between the global north and global south, that people who were actually looking at the justice question within India, they were not directly working with climate folks in India. And so I thought, there's a major gap here that I need to fill before I can actually do urban climate justice. And so that got me into thinking about bringing together a group of scholars who would contribute insights and fresh insights based on their ongoing research. And it was just then that we were hit by COVID crisis. And so I was incredibly lucky to have assembled a group of scholars and activists and activist scholars and poets and artists who were all sort of, you know, willing and able to contribute voluntary labor to the this book project, and that's how it kind of took shape.
All right, and so you started to talk a little bit about what my next question is, which is, you know, climate justice is something that's relevant and important for any country in the world. So can you talk about some of the ways that the situation in India specifically is, you know, maybe unique, special, different from other parts of the world, but then also on the other hand, you know, what are some of the ways that the situation in India is comparable to or similar to what we'd find elsewhere in the world?
Sure. So as I said, you know, one of the unique features of the Indian context is that the whole sort of, in a way, the movement for international climate justice was sort of, you know, sort of came from India, both on the scholarly side as well as on the you know, government negotiation side. So there's a very famous book on sort of climate colonialism that two environmental activists from India, Anil Agarwal and Sunita Narayan, they wrote about this whole notion of differential responsibility for the stock of accumulated greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so they came up with this notion of differentiated responsibility and this kind of notion of the atmospheric space and the equity question within atmospheric space. And then within that work, they also came up with this notion of luxury emissions versus subsistence or survival emissions. So, you know, this concept of climate justice actually had a lot stronger grounding in India and in Indian activism compared to what is generally known within the climate justice communities. So that's one part that's important to think about. But the way that concept of differential contribution to atmospheric stock of greenhouse gases got mainstreamed into international negotiation and leading up to the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, which is one of the underlying principles at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. The whole discussion kind of got, I wouldn't say appropriated, because all of the actors who are involved in this discussion, they actually liked it and they promoted it, and this was important and it's been a massive contribution. But one potentially or probably an unintended consequence of this focus on international justice was that the question of justice within India has not been really taken up in the public domain so much. And in fact, for many, many people within India, both on the activist side as well as on the climate scholarship side, the discussions of climate justice are sort of synonymous with international climate justice. And again, so this is, you know, all of the claims and arguments about international climate justice are valid. And the way in which we try to nuance this discussion shouldn't be used as an excuse by the global north, by the industrialized countries, to say that, look, you know, why don't you address problems within your countries? You know, I think that's for them to address, but global north still need to be to be held accountable. So India is unique in this sense that it has been a leader in advocating for international climate justice, but at the same time, especially the Indian government has completely neglected the question of climate justice within India. And this is precisely where this volume seeks to intervene. And the hope is that by eliminating this challenge within India, we can kickstart a broader debate on what climate justice means internationally, but also domestically within each of the countries. And these could be countries in either global south or global north.
Okay. So then in your introduction to the book, you don't mince words in saying that market-based climate policy is a mistake. So Why is that?
Right. Thank you for picking up on that. And I think, as I say somewhere, I think I say that in the preface about this time in international climate negotiation, when beginning in 2007, the Bali Conference of Parties meeting, this idea of market-based instruments in climate change came in very heavily into international negotiations. And it was sort of taking off fresh from the success of the sulfur dioxide emission reduction credit markets that were built within the United States. And so, the argument was that, look, this has been so successful in the context of acid rain and reducing sulfur dioxide within US, so it has to be successful internationally. And I distinctly remember getting into this, these arguments, both with my environmental economics professor at Indiana University, as well as some of the graduates, senior graduates within the program there. And extremely clear to me that this was not going to work, because if you go to the basics of what markets require, for functioning of effective markets, you require clearly defined property rights. You require a basic semblance of the enforcement of rule of law, and you require a reasonable level of information symmetries, which means that all the players in a market have reasonable level of information about the product that is being sold and bought. That's how markets work. I'm just going by the economics definition, right? We don't even have to actually get to all of the serious critiques from political ecology and other critical social sciences. Even if we went by the sort of textbook definition of markets, it would be clear that a market in quasi-commodities such as emission reduction credits, right? I mean, to think about that as a commodity is itself sort of brain twisting in many, many ways. So it was obvious that this was not going to work to any of us who were actually thinking about the fundamentals. But, this market-based climate mitigation has such strong advocates who hold enormous amount of political and social capital within global climate negotiations, that we actually had to discover it the hard way. And now, last week there was this report where researchers here in the US have actually conducted satellite-based data on carbon emissions over California. And they've actually shown that California carbon offset market has not been successful in reducing emissions.
Yeah, I've been kind of skeptical of those market-based approaches for a while, and I've been hoping that I would be wrong, and it's sounding more and more like I wasn't. I'm getting more and more of that data to show that those kind of interventions don't accomplish what they're promising to accomplish.
Right, and I think just to add this one quick point that as we say in the research methodology world, that you have best case and the most difficult case. And so, the reason I cited California carbon offsets program is that if a market-based carbon credits program could succeed anywhere in the world, it would be California, right? You got all of the conditions that I talked about are close to being met in the Californian context. But it didn't work there. And so even forget about even sort of, venturing out to even sort of suggest that this might work in the context of international offset emission programs, where, you have folks here in the US or in Europe, making emissions and then offsetting it by doing things in the global south. And so once you sort of go over the jurisdictions that have dramatically different levels and types of rule of law framework and respect or lack of respect for property rights and all of those conditions, then, you don't even begin to actually define a market. Forget about making it successful. So it's actually quite shocking why economists would argue for an international carbon offset market of all the people, you know, just going by their own sort of fundamental theoretical arguments.
Right, right. Okay, so I want to now talk a bit about energy in India, because you know, India's got this big existing coal industry, and then there's this emerging solar power sector. And, you know, from sort of a conventional climate policy standpoint, you might think, well, these are, you know, basically opposite ways of producing energy, right? Coal is bad, replace it all with solar, and that's good. But from a climate justice standpoint, it's not that simple. And I think your book shows there's some similarities, actually, in the types of injustice that can result from both coal and solar development. So can you talk about some of the pros and cons of the way that solar is being developed in India?
Right. And that, so I'll take that. I think that's a wonderfully framed question, you know, sort of putting coal and renewables side by side. And I think this is, you know, another of sort of interesting features from this collection, that we have two chapters that sort of talk about it. There's, you know, the contribution by Dr. Vasudha Chotre, who's a senior lecturer at University of East Anglia. And she has studied for many years, she has studied the extractive economies of around coal in central India. And she has made this argument about there being an extractive regime. So it's not just about, you know, just pure and simple market-based or even state-driven extraction of coal from these mines and an exploitation of the environment and communities in the process. But Dr. Chotre talks about these extractive regimes. So there are these powerful actors in both the state and markets, and they are kind of interlocked with one another in supporting one another. And so her argument is that thinking about just transition in the Indian context has to be based on a careful, nuanced understanding of these extractive regimes, because it is these regimes who are going to drive the conversation and the changes around this whole notion of just transition. And so she's sort of trying to preempt that by making an argument about centering a more careful understanding of how this economy is structured and what it means to transition out of this economy in a way that it doesn't come at the cost of the poorest people. And I think a lot of people from, you know, if I understood correctly from a lot of my interactions here in the U.S., I think India actually has, for a variety of reasons, not least of which being the impressive quote-unquote economic growth that we have seen over, you know, nearly a quarter of a century now, has really confused people. Because within India, we have extreme levels of poverty that are comparable to some of the poorest places in Africa, and you have these, you know, what I referred elsewhere as compulsions of marginality. When you have people who are so, you know, compromised by the sheer need to survive and subsist within a given context, that, you know, many of the inequalities within Indian economy are simply sort of swept under the carpet of the macro narratives that you see in the global north. And I mean, almost invariably, when I describe the data and the actual kinds of the realities of inequalities in India, there's almost like an incredulous, you know, sort of, you know, a lack of belief in things, that things could be that bad. And things are really that bad. And so coal economy actually rides on this massive poverty. And, you know, in the introduction chapter, I described these fires, the underground fires that have been burning for, you know, as long as we've been an independent country. And in fact, even from before then. And people have been living in those areas, you know, and some people who were displaced, they've been worse off going to new places where it's not supposed to be burning underground, but they still want to actually come back to the places that they've been quote-unquote rescued from. So anyway, long answer short, the main point that Dr. Chotra is making is that it's not about just about moving from coal to renewable and taking care of some labor issues, as the discussion is framed in the Global North context. But because of this combination of the regime of powerful actors and the extreme poverty and compulsions of unemployment and lack of alternatives and all of that, it's a much more sort of wicked, you know, if we could use that phrase from Wicked Policy Problem, it's a much wicked problem, and we'll need much more broad-based discussions for us to even begin to design some very effective just transition frameworks in the context of coal in India. And that's, you know, that's interesting. And actually, Dr. Chotre makes this argument towards the end of the chapter that, the actors who are powerful in the coal economy are already actually beginning to take control of the renewable energy sector. So that's interesting, and I'll let the readers read more about that. But the chapter that we have on the solar energy transition in India, and they're focusing mainly on the power sector reforms and the sort of the policy architecture that seem to be building around the transition to renewable-based grid systems. And so they are arguing that while renewable energy is often thought as being almost like synonymous with decentralized power and small-scale grid development, the Indian mindset of the bureaucracy and the leadership is such that they are in the process of building this gigantic, centralized, massive grid structure that will essentially replace the ongoing current coal-based and other fossil fuel-based grid system that is massive and centralized, at least in the production sense. And so they're kind of replacing one centralized system with another centralized system, and that can never be just in any meaningful sense, because India is so big and so vast with all of the diversity of, regional differences of development, economy, social context, geographical context, that we have to think in a more decentralized way if we are serious about, making this into a just transition. But that doesn't seem to be on the horizon so far.
And then I wanted to ask you about some of the forms of inequality within India that affect climate justice. And so if we could start with caste-based discrimination. So how does caste play into climate justice or injustice?
Right. So, and again, I'm mentioning the contributors because, they should also... it's their work. Of course, I played a role in sort of steering and curating the work. So the chapter on caste proper, there's one chapter that is devoted exclusively to caste, which is by Srilata Shirkar from King's College in London. And then there are three or four other chapters that, bring in caste in various ways. And so I'll quickly sort of mention them without mentioning the individual chapters, but I'll mention the issues here. Caste, as I hope most of the listeners would know, is a fundamental feature of Indian society. And sometimes, there's a tendency to sort of talk about caste in the past tense as if this used to be a bad reality of India and we are getting out of it. On the contrary, we have actually are in many ways the ongoing political environment has actually strengthened, and particularly in the context of the rise of the right-wing populism, they actually ride on caste divisions and caste identities, and there's this whole thing called social engineering. This is a phrase that you'll hear in Indian news telecast around the election times. And this is almost taken as like, as something that is, if not good, that's like, it's part of the reality. And so elections are fought along the caste lines and candidates are chosen and electoral strategies are designed along the caste line in almost all of the elections in India. So it's a deep reality of the Indian social, political, and economic structure as well as the legal structure. So some people may not realize that even the judiciary, I mean, the inner workings of judiciary are sometimes organized around the caste lines so that, you know, judges and lawyers and, you know, other people in the legal fraternity, they are sort of connected to one another through these caste networks and, you know, and you can imagine the rest, right? With notable exception of, you know, social activists and civil rights advocates and human rights advocates who've been fighting these battles. So one, I wanted to sort of emphasize without being able to explain the details of how the caste system worked, because that would take another podcast, right? without having to do that, I just want to really emphasize that it's something, it's the blood that runs inside the body of Indian politic and polity writ large and political economy writ large. So in the context of climate change, there is in most places, both in urban and rural areas, there's segregation, residential segregation along caste lines. And so you can imagine the areas where the so-called lower caste people live and work. These are the areas that have poor infrastructure, oftentimes very little sort of stormwater management. Their neighborhoods are constantly flooded. Access to safe drinking water is problematic and non-existent in some places. They have to sometimes, especially in rural areas, women have to travel miles to get their daily supply of drinking water. So, in many cases, they are carrying every ounce of drinking water supply on their head in these sort of pitchers, these big utensils. And it's mostly women, almost all the time, the women who have to do this. And so any kind of stress on the on water, on urban systems, on heat waves. I'm sure listeners have heard about the reports that the World Bank has come out with in terms of how serious the impacts of the heat waves are going to be on the outdoor wage labor, and all of that outdoors. Wage labor is done by the so-called lower caste people because they are forced, because of both historical and contemporary reasons, they are forced to work in the lowest paying jobs, which is in the constructions. Almost all of India's municipal staff who's responsible for cleaning of the sewers and maintenance of the very primitively built drainage systems in the Indian society, they're all sometimes even by formal, I mean, there are places where it's actually on the paper, like black and white, that we are going to recruit more cleaners from these particular so-called lower caste people. But practically, literally all of the India's municipal workforce is made of members of the lower caste communities, and in any kinds of post-disaster scenarios, these municipal workers who are on temporary government payroll, in some cases they are permanent, but mostly they are on temporary precarious kind of employment conditions, they are forced to clean up after the disaster with their bare hands without as much as gloves or boots to use when you have, sometimes you have bodies and, of course, a large number of animal carcasses and, bodies floating in the floods. And there were horrible reports after the floods in 2015 in Chennai and then, in every major flood that we can remember. So this is to say that if you think about one section of Indian society that is taking on, you know, and I'll just, you know, make up some percentage here, but taking on, let's say, 65% of the injustices of climate that are foisted on Indian society, those would be the lowest caste people. And then you have the indigenous people, Adivasis, who are often considered to be outside of the caste system, but even below or at par with these so-called lower caste and so-called untouchables or former untouchables. The, you know, practices of untouchability still continue. And so then you have the indigenous people, and their resources are subjected to land grab and green grab and mineral grab. And these people have been indigenous people. The Adivasis in India have been displaced multiple times in many places. Whenever they are displaced, they are supposed to fend for themselves. They're not given legal titles to the land that they are, quote unquote, moved to, these new lands, by government agencies. And some new project will come up and will displace them again. So, and you know, I'm kind of describing these nuts and bolts. And you know, some of these things are not even in the book, actually. So the caste chapter offers a more sort of deep dive into the history of urban development in India and how it shapes the way we deal with urban climate governance and urban climate justice issues. But all of these other factors that I talk about, the displacement, the cleaning of the sewers and the post-disaster cleanup, and, you know, without any facilities of you know, equipment or any kind of even the basic, you know, tools that you need to do any kind of cleaning, is to say that, it's actually difficult to talk about. And I wanted to sort of paint a little bit of a graphic picture, because, you know, I think most people here in the US and elsewhere in the industrially advanced countries, they you know, unless you study this stuff, you know, like many of us do, they really don't know, you know, what is it that caste means in the Indian context. So I think I did go off on a bit of a tangent, but I hope it was helpful to sort of contextualize the whole thing.
No, that was great. And in the process there, right, of course, all these things are intersectional. So you mentioned gender as part of your discussion of caste there, but I was hoping you could say a little more about gender and climate justice and kind of what your book adds to the conversation on that topic.
Right. So I already mentioned the question of, you know, simple sourcing of drinking water, right? And there are active physical barriers in the sense that in many places like the state of Gujarat, that, you know, India's prime minister was leading many years before he became the prime minister and is supposed to be one of the growth stories in the country. There are places where Dalits, the so-called lower caste people, are not allowed to get water from particular wells, because these wells are off-bound. They cannot, these Dalits cannot touch the water, because the water get, you know, if Dalit touches the well, the whole water gets polluted. That's the idea, you know. And so there are actual physical and social barriers to simple access to clean and safe drinking water in many, many places. And because women, within Dalit households, women have the responsibility to procure water, in many cases, and this is, you know, almost like a trigger warning here, but, you know, one wouldn't imagine that, you know, this difficult journey of having to secure drinking water supply every day for your household would then lead to, you know, harassment, physical harassment, in some many cases, sexual exploitation. Just to get water, women are forced to go through indignities and kind of experiences that you wouldn't actually imagine. So there's a constant thread of violation of bodily dignity of Dalit women, young Dalit girls, who need to fetch their supply of drinking water for their household. Then there are questions related to. So one of the chapters that I co-authored with a young academic and journalist, Vaishnavi Behel, we talk about this North Indian state, Uttaranchal, where there are supposed to be many of these natural springs. And these springs have been maintained through traditions and local cultures and community-based initiatives. So these are the springs and sources of drinking water that are often celebrated in the scholarship on climate adaptation and climate resilience. But because these springs exist within this particular social context that is divided and subjected to the violence of gender and caste and the intersection of two, there are prohibitions around menstruating women not being allowed to again touch the source of the water, and there are other sources of water where women bathe and wash clothes, and again, precisely during the days when they would need to have access to, bathing and washing, they are actually prohibited from availing of that access to waters because of social taboos around menstruation. In some places, we've had reports of, girl students not being able to go to school because of menstruation and the taboos around that. So the intersection of gender and caste presents almost insurmountable, an insurmountable given the social context that we have. And what is interesting about this North Indian context of climate adaptation and climate resilience through these traditional water sources is that there have been projects by World Bank, and some of this research has been done by scholars such as Deepa Joshi, whose work we actually draw on, and she shows how these projects by multilateral agencies and NGOs who are supposed to be progressive are also subjected to the same sort of social grammar and same sort of social matrices of exclusions and inclusions. And so, intersectionality appears in very, very complicated ways. But there is also hope. We have a remarkable chapter on agroecology, the promotion of agroecology in two different South Indian states, Kerala and Tamil Nadu, where the state governments have come up with policies to allow women farmers access to land through land leasing programs, and then support these women collective farmers and farm operations through state-supported programs on agroecology promotion. And so, Ashlesha Kadse and Kavita Srinivasan, who are two young scholars and scholars activists, both of them are agroecology activists, and they show how intersectional agroecological justice actually shows such a big promise in the Indian context, where we still have a large population that relies on farming and agriculture of different sorts. And women's land rights have historically been not recognized properly. But, through the work of many advocates, including scholars such as Abhinav Agarwal, globally celebrated economist, who has devoted enormous amount of effort and time to sort of research and document and to advocate for women's land rights, I think we have had some progress over the past couple of decades. And this is one big area that any multilateral agencies or even scholars who are thinking about researching on questions of climate justice and particularly in the context of gender justice, this can be a real big focus in India and many other global society, global South countries with similar kind of socioeconomic and agricultural sort of profile of their economies.
Okay, so I've gotten to ask you a whole bunch about the kind of traditional scholarship pieces of the book, but I also wanted to highlight that the book also includes some poetry and some visual art along with the, you know, typical scholarly chapters. So could you talk a little bit about first why you included those pieces, you know, how you went about soliciting them from the book, and then also maybe, you know, pick one or two of your favorites to tell us a little more about.
Right. So the inclusion of poems and artwork was actually inspired by another collective project that I'm involved in, that is in collaboration with my longtime collaborators and friends and colleagues, Gustavo Garcia Lopez, and my former professor from Indiana University, Lauren Morris McLean. We are involved. We are currently almost finalizing another edited volume on climate justice in the city. So that's specifically focused on that urban climate justice agenda that I mentioned previously. And that's a globally focused, you know, both global north and global south. So in that community, there was a lot of discussion about the importance of art and poetry. And so I got inspired by that discussion and sort of, you know, took that idea very seriously and implemented in this volume. But it actually, you know, completely credit to that group and that community that you know, for all those inspiring discussions. There are two things that, you know, made me seriously invest a lot of time in soliciting, and, you know, especially the poetry and the translation was way more challenging than I had first anticipated, but it was also a lot of fun. One is, I think there's an increasing acknowledgement among scholars who, and especially, you know, academics in Global North, and particularly those people who are in the, you know, tenure system and who think of themselves as research heavy, scholarship heavy academics and so forth, that our scholarship is so dense and convoluted and sort of, you know, inaccessible to a vast majority of people who fund our research through public funding and all that, right? And so I think there's this realization and a lot of debates and discussions on Twitter and on at conferences, which I think has been instrumental in shaping, you know, my sort of resolve that, you know, all of our scholarship, however deep we want to make it, you know, in an academic theoretical sense, it has to be written in an accessible way and it had to be presented in a way that is accessible to the broader audience. And we have, you know, attempted this. It's not always easy. It's always a work in progress. You know, all of us need to learn to do that kind of writing, which is dramatically different from scholarly writing. So that whole agenda of, you know, simplifying and making scholarship accessible was you know, instrumental in motivating me to do that. And if you don't mind, I would actually probably talk about real quick about three different pieces, and just that's sure. To illustrate the second argument that I make about why it is important. So, you know, see how when I was talking about the cast, I had to go through this long-winded discussion and giving you several examples of how deeply pervasive the reality of caste in Indian society is, right? And so some of those things can never be adequately captured in scholarly pieces, partly because of the vastness and the interconnectedness of these, all of these different topics, and the sheer compulsion of keeping any volume in a manageable shape and all of that, right? But sometimes a poem can actually capture a lot of that stuff in just a few sort of, you know, paragraphs. So just to give you two quick examples, there's a poem by Pranita Modiliar, who's a scholar of environmental policy and climate and climate justice here in the U.S. And moving now to Toronto, and she wrote this absolutely amazing amazing poem while she was doing her field work, where she talks about how caste appears. Anyone who does field work actually has to deal with the caste, because as I said, it's everywhere. You cannot escape the reality of caste, no matter what you're doing. So she talks about talking to, you know, interviewing these people during her field research, and one of her interviewees actually talks about a friend that they want, friend's house that they want to go to, and then sort of describes in this poem how their houses are different. So, you know, in you have one house, the thatched house that has two rooms, a kitchen and a room of everything else. A kitchen and a room of everything else. The house is dark even in the daytime. Gaps in the thatched roof send sharp streaks of light, cutting the air like a knife. So, you know, sort of describing what the house of a lower, so-called low-caste household may look like. And then this interviewee 10 takes me to the house of his best friend, and that house has seven rooms and courtyard with that is open to sky, awash with sunlight, and on, right? And I thought this was, you know, I mean, this is really powerful, both in terms of sort of, you know, bringing to life a reality that all of us have dealt with. But, you know, if you look at the scholarship on environmental questions and climate questions in India and most of the other kind of social science questions, caste has really been invisibilized. And we have colleagues now who are valiantly fighting about, you know, questions of caste discrimination and the ugly ways in which caste realities shape the academic institutions. And in particular, I would like to mention a professor at Indian Institute of Bangalore, Deepak Malgan, who's been collecting data, analyzing the faculty representation, lack of representation among PhD scholars and so forth. So, you know, I really liked Pranita sort of bringing this reality out. And then we have a poem by in Adivasi indigenous activist and poet Waharu Sonawane, and his poem is actually addressing a social movement, a very renowned social movement that all of us who have worked in the social sciences on the questions of social justice, we owe a great amount of debt to the social movement, and I'm talking about the Narmada Bachao Andolan, Save Narmada campaign that many in the global community actually know about. But the functioning of the movement, for a variety of very complicated reasons that I actually document in one of the chapters in this book, that functioning of the movement was controlled almost entirely, the leadership was controlled almost entirely by middle class outsiders who weren't actually rooted in the context that they were supposedly fighting for. So Adivasi activist and leader Waharu and poet Waharu Sonwane talks about this gap between the leadership and the followership in the movement. And he says, "We didn't go to the stage, nor were we called. With a wave of the hand, we were shown our place. There we sat and were congratulated. And they, standing on the stage, kept on telling us of our sorrows. Our sorrows remained ours. They never became theirs." And you know, every time I read this poem, it sort of makes me very emotional. And I had the fantastic opportunity to actually talk to Waharu Sonwane, and he's such a delightfully insightful activist and visionary. So that was one of the perks of being able to do that, to have an opportunity to talk to the poets and the artists and so forth.
All right. So I think we've taken up quite a bit of your time. So to move into our closing questions, first, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were working on this book.
Right. Absolutely. Of course, it can be a very long list, so I won't go through all the names, but in particular, in addition to the editors at Cambridge University Press, Anvesha Rana and Qudsi Ahmed, who were extremely supportive through this long-winded process, got interrupted because of COVID. I've been saying this on some public venues that, in academia, most of the edited volumes are often a product of some conference or some project that people are doing, and they come together as part of a panel or something. And this volume didn't, have its origin in any of that. There was no funding. I was lucky to have fellowships through the Human Rights Institute at the University of Connecticut, so that I was able to devote my time. But the contributors, the poets, the artists, they work pro bono and on their time and through. And some of them actually had to drop out because they were they needed to work on the COVID crisis. We had plans for a chapter on migration, and the activist professionals who were working on that chapter, they had to devote themselves to addressing the massive out migration crisis that occurred because of COVID. So we didn't have that chapter. So I'm incredibly grateful to all of the contributors who were able to pull this off in the middle of such trying times. And lastly, we have made the book open access, and this is thanks to the support of the India Climate Collaborative, which is a fantastic institution that is supporting many, many innovative interventions in the Indian climate space. And India Climate Collaborative is being supported in turn by Adele Give Foundation and the Friends of Adele Give Foundation in the U.S., who supported actually sort of paid for making this volume open access. So I'm incredibly thankful to both the India Climate Collaborative as well as the Adele Give Foundation as well.
All right, yeah, and it's open access, so listeners, you have no excuse not to go read it. So as our final question, we always like to ask, what are you working on next?
Right. So as I mentioned, I'm working on another collaborative project, Climate Justice in the City, and we are just about finished the curating and the collection of the chapters, and hopefully it'll come out towards the end of the next year or the year after. But my main solo project right now is on a project that is tentatively titled as Governing for Justice, and that focuses on environmental and climate justice governance here in the U.S. And this has been a work in progress for the last 4 years or so, and again got interrupted because of COVID quite a bit, but I'm making very serious headways now, and so hopefully in a couple of years that book project, which is on an advanced contract with Oxford University Press. Hopefully that will be out too. And the main argument I make there is to sort of focus more carefully on the policy process and policy design to ensure that we actually address the injustices, environmental injustice and climate injustices, because a lot of there's a kind of a division of labor between scholars who focus on an analysis of climate justice and climate injustices versus people who work on policy. And policy is supposed, you know, it has been mainly a positivist, sort of sometimes a bit reductive kind of field. And so I'm bringing my training in the policy sciences and policy process side of things to bridge along with a lot of my recent work on environmental and climate justice. So I'm a bit nervous, but quite excited about this new project as well.
Yeah, it sounds great. And hopefully we can have you back on the podcast sometime to talk about it.
Absolutely. It'll be a great pleasure and privilege.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Stanton. Thanks a lot. Yeah, we look forward to connect with any of your listeners. I would really welcome them reaching out to me or any of the contributors to talk about these questions that we bring about in this volume.
All right. So this has been a conversation with Prakash Kashwan, editor of Climate Justice in India, published this year by Cambridge University Press.